Hello and welcome to The Intersection. We're the podcast where marketing, sales, operations, and technology stop working in silos and start driving real growth for building materials brands. I'm Megan Kavinsky, CEO of Point to Point. We're a sales and marketing agency helping mid-market building materials manufacturers build the marketing engine and sales culture they've never had and always wanted. Each episode, I'm joined by Steve Coffey, Senior Managing Partner of Coffey & Co., a growth and strategy firm focused in building materials, and Deneen Harper, founder of DHX Consulting and a fractional CMO for, you guessed it, building materials brands. We're here to close the gaps between marketing and sales, strategy and operations, technology and execution, because in those gaps, you bleed margin. And we're going to show you how to stop it. No fluff, just what works. Hello, and welcome to The Intersection. I'm Megan Kavinsky. I'm the CEO of Point to Point, and I'm joined by my esteemed co-hosts, Steve Coffey and Deneen Harper. Steve is the Senior Managing Partner of Coffey & Co., a growth strategy firm in building materials, and Deneen is the founder and a fractional CMO of DHX Consulting. She's also a partner in the Coffey & Co. business. So great to be here with Steve and Deneen. Today, we're going to be talking about websites, but we're not here to do the normal things to watch out for in a website or what architects want or, you know, how do you structure it for different building materials audiences. We're here to talk about the four hidden organizational change decisions that you need to be prepared to make when you go through a website redesign. This is where the website can get bigger if you're not ready, and it's also where you're going to get slowed down. So the four things are your sample fulfillment, scaling your CEUs, how you handle your distribution locator, your distributor locator, and customer service. So let's begin to break these down. We're going to start by talking about the sample order. So we see this a lot where when you start a website, you maybe are still doing sample order fulfillment internally. So you have like a marketing manager, someone in your production facility that is in charge of sample orders and goes out through your normal shipment process. But when you do a website redesign, your agency or whoever is doing it is going to tell you, hey, you want more leads? We got to drive more sample requests, right? So that sample ordering experience is going to get a significant uptick in the number of requests. And so there's a couple things you need to be prepared for: cost, inventory, and bandwidth, right? And this is when we see a lot of companies make the decision to outsource their sample ordering because it becomes just too much for one person to do internally. So there's a lot to the sample ordering. Steve, Deneen, I'm curious, like, have you seen a website get stuck here or seen an organization struggle with this? Or, you know, what's your experience been like?
I've seen that happen. When I worked at PGT, we remodeled the website. Our sample request almost tripled at that time. And we had a part-time person.
Well done. Yeah.
Well, thank you. We had a part-time person working in-house. And we had to actually build them a space on the floor, hire a full-time person, and then also have a drop ship that would come in every single day as opposed to waiting to go out to certain distributors and dealers with a regular order. We had to get those out immediately because a lot of clients and customers really wanted them right away.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing too. It's like the quick turn in the sample order experience is so important. Like if you are shipping things a couple weeks after they're arriving a couple weeks after the initial request, they've already forgotten about you. I mean, a lot of times I don't remember what happened yesterday, you know, nonetheless, you know, what happened a couple weeks ago. So,
or the bid is over and you've just lost the spec.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. It's interesting, Deneen, that you did it all in-house still. I'm surprised that you'd made the decision to keep it all internally, though, from what you were sharing.
Well, I think because it was a complex process and they had tried a couple of vendors before I even worked there. And there were people on the floor that had a lot of experience and could build them quickly.
Because it's custom?
Yes.
Yeah.
And a lot of different colors, shapes, sizes, materials. So it was just easier to have an experienced person with the product build them. They could get them out a lot quicker. You couldn't really streamline it into, you know, like an easy process.
Yeah, there's not an easy like a fulfillment sort of pull and pack and ship sort of thing, because there's actual assembly. Is that what you're saying that would need to occur of the product too? Interesting.
Right. Plus just the sheer amount of different glass and tints and colors that were available. It just didn't make sense.
I think a lot of company, like third party vendors, have gotten better at the complexity that exists within that. But I most of what I've experienced with mid-market companies, the smaller companies, is that they're going to keep it in-house. They're not going to go to a third party just because they want to have that control. But the sad thing that I see as it relates to samples is the disconnect between the sales team and the actual sample request process and the fulfillment process. It's, and I don't know if you both have experienced this, but the vast majority of the companies that I have dealt with just treat it as something that we're going to do. It's just people request samples. Let's get the samples out. Let's get it out to the architects and interior designers. And then they have it. And then that's great. That's just a marketing thing that we do. And it's not really connected to the sales teams and the follow-up and the relationship building. So I think it should be utilized as a beginning of an overall relationship that you have with an architectural firm or an interior designer, or as new products come out. It's a sales tool. It's not just something that we do in the organization to get the name out there. And I think that's where you have a lot of lift as it relates to your website and how you do samples, is making sure that those are connected, is sales and marketing, and how you follow up on them, how you turn that into actual business.
Well, that's a great point, because fortunately, in my experience, I haven't seen the sales team ignore them, but I have seen a sales team struggle with them, and particularly as they scale, right? Where the volume of leads can become overwhelming to a sales organization, and their ability to identify who is a real prospect from the sample ordering versus who was just someone kind of browsing and isn't as urgent. You know, like I would say any sample order could be considered important, but not all are urgent, right? In terms of where they are in their selection criteria. So they all need to be followed up. So that's where marketing, I think, can really help, because they can do a lot more nurturing. You can see who's engaging with further content. They can tell more of that story. And then sales teams still need to be calling, you know, so marketing's up here, keeping the brand top of mind. And then sales is coming in and, you know, doing that very proactive, very targeted outreach, right? And that's the other thing that I see a disconnect on, though, is you can tell who's really got their sample order experience together or not. This is a big part of what we do in our AEC strategy, is we actually audit the sample order in experience of our customers and their competitors. And what we're looking for is the customer experience in the sample kit connected to email? How quickly did someone from sales reach out? Are we getting any sort of marketing communication? And a couple times, and even for some of our clients that we were sharing it with, they were so proud of the sample kit that they had created. But then we showed them how they did not have a best-in-class customer experience surrounding it. Like, yeah, your sample kit kicks butt. Like, your competitors would kill to have this, but they're doing a better job connecting the whole thing. So they're probably winning, even though the product sample is not as desirable as what you're sending out.
That brings up a really good point, because you can ask simple questions on your lead form as well to find out basic information. And a lot of salespeople prefer to deliver the sample because it gives them the opportunity to speak to the prospect or the current customer. And just by having a couple of questions on the sample order form gives them a little bit of inroad into what that communication is going to look like.
Well, the other thing, so, and going back to what you were saying, Steve, about the insourcing and the outsourcing of the sample order experience, and sort of where we started some of this, you know, it's been interesting to watch Material Bank and Swatchbox and how they handle all these things. And I still think that Material Bank and Swatchbox are great, like fully vertically integrated opportunities if you're looking for sample volume and lead volume at scale. But I think the reason that a lot of mid-market building materials companies keep it in-house is that they don't think about the fact that you can do sampling through like a regular old fulfillment partner. You don't have to use these big guys that are very expensive in terms of what, or can be, I shouldn't say they always are, but you know, historically have been more expensive, where we've had great success with, you know, fulfillment partners. Like we have one sample order fulfillment partner that even has a CNC machine in-house. And so the cutting of the sample, I have two clients who moved to them that are like, oh my God, this saved my marriage because my wife was about to murder me for all of the machining that I was doing to get the samples cut in my garage, you know? And so there's just a lot of other options that are out there about how you can do sampling. It doesn't have to be in-house or Swatchbox material bank. There's a bunch of stuff in a middle layer that can help get you leveraged before you would go into something that's more lead gen and all these other components that are a part of it.
Yeah, I would like to say too, for me personally, and I'd like to hear both of your opinions on it. I think a company, now this is dependent on the category and the product, and obviously it's a little bit easier with certain products than others in how you go to market, et cetera. But I do think a company should absolutely do samples, because I think that's the connection between experiential marketing and digital marketing that I think we lose very quickly. We can opt to say, we're not going to do samples. We're not going to hassle with it. So I was doing a deck build just at my house, and I was trying to decide between which decking material to do. And I was reading a lot of literature online. I had talked to two deck builders, and one of the deck builders gave me a Trek sample, and he put it into my hands. He sent it to me and put it into my hands. And he said, take a look at this. This is what I'm recommending you go with. And I made the decision to go with it because I felt something, right? It was in my hands, and I was able to look at it. It just made a difference to me as the end user. So I think for some categories and for some products, I think it's absolutely necessary that you do samples and you make that decision. I think it needs to be connected with a very strong digital marketing campaign as well, retargeting, staying in front of that individual. And obviously that's going to change a little bit if it is an architect or an interior designer. But I just want to put it on the record. I think companies should absolutely be doing it. Like, I think it's very important in today's world where so much of our interaction with a brand is digital or with a rep, that samples will make a difference.
Yeah, I mean, working exclusively in architectural products, I very rarely run into someone who's not doing sampling for all the reasons that you just said, Steve. So maybe if it's more direct to contractor or sold through big box retail, but in my world, everyone has a sampling program, you know. So actually this credenza behind me here is like my material library for all of the sample orders. And I really like the TimberTech decking sample is back over here. I think they do a very nice job with how they handle it, you know, so I would highly recommend. I think we should move to our second topic, which is CEUs. So CEUs, our continuing education units, are another thing that you're going to be told you need to raise as a CTA to get more inbound leads through your website when you're updating it, if you have a specified product. The CEU itself, a lot of companies are maybe have like one or two when we start working with them, one that's outdated or one that's really great that's like HSW certification and they only want to give in person. But not all architects want that in-person CEU, and not all architecture firms are worth your time to travel out there, you know, without knowing the qualification of the audience. CEUs and lunch and learns can get to be very expensive when you add up your time and the travel and how all that works. So if you're getting more CEU requests and you don't want to tell people, no, you can't take my CEU, you know, like, thanks for your interest, architectural firm, but, you know, we're just not that into you. Like, you have to figure out how you have solutions that scale. So this is where having a couple of different CEUs is something that can be very beneficial, where you have one that you maybe save for prime time in person only, but then you have one or two others that are available either on demand or you can deliver virtually that you're more comfortable sharing at scale, not necessarily on a one-to-one, on a one-to-many basis. Do you guys agree, disagree? What do you see?
I've seen that, and I've also seen a lot of in-house universities that do that as opposed to marketing. Like that's their function is to, you know, build all the install videos, do the CEUs, you know, train new dealers, distributors, or even big box, whoever, you know, they're going to market with. So I think it's a really important part. Where I see some dysfunction with it, if they do have an academy or a university online, a lot of times they're not connected to sales or to marketing, and nobody really understands what they're doing. And then you're put in these situations when, like, a product is going to market, you're launching a new product, you want to get it specified with new architects and therefore, and no one tells training. So there you go. You launch this product and now you're in a situation where you don't have the information online. They don't have the information. And in reality, they could have helped you really build a launch program that could get you in front of the architects with the information that they're looking for with that CEU program.
Yeah, it sounds like the people who you worked with, Deneen, are a step ahead of some of the people who I've had the opportunity to work with, and that they have like this in-house training and education library and the way of handling it, because that sounds amazing. But you're right, same thing that we talked about with sample ordering is that disconnect of that organizational alignment and that whole reason why this podcast even exists. It's everyone's doing their function like the right way. You know, we have training and we're getting a CEU together and all. But it's that final quarter mile where product or training and marketing don't talk exactly the way they need to, that you bleed the margin out. That's the intersection, right? Like that's exactly what's happening right there. It's like this program isn't maximizing the value that it could because we didn't get all the stakeholders on the same page, right? And it's like everyone's doing best, like your story is amazing because it's like really good stuff, really best in class, like ways to deploy this. And it still is going awry at times, right? You know, so.
And I've seen it delivered through salespeople, not at all, have no training whatsoever, or have, you know, a very small kind of training or YouTube channel that they connect to their website. So I think, you know, there's a lot of different companies that do it in multiple different ways. And, you know, this kind of connection that we're talking about today to the website and to the sales team and the marketing team is really important.
The thing that I'm curious about in the world that you just described, and even on the YouTube side of it, is the big incentive for an architect to take the CEU is to get that it's to learn about the products, right? You know, not the products because you can't talk about the products, but to learn about the category or whatever you're being educated on, but it's to get that continuing education unit. And that's where the brand still has to go back and register that, you know, ABC person, or I should say, you know, Joe Schmo took CEUB, right? And gets, you know, whatever number of hours. That's where we help guide people more frequently to use a third party like AEC Daily or AceLab, where you can actually connect to their external CEU hosting platform so you can offer an on-demand experience that then those platforms automatically register with AIA. So it does sort of relieve you of that organizational need to track the reporting function of it. Not to say you shouldn't track who took it from a sales perspective, but that more admin level, they have direct integrations in with how they work with the AIA and they're able to get that credit submitted and validated for you, you know, with no manpower from your team.
I think that's a really good point. I think a lot of companies don't even realize that you can go to like an ACE lab and integrate that in that way. Yeah. So just, you know, being able to share that part of it and have a lot of brands understand that there are these third party platforms out there that will make it a lot easier.
For sure. Steve, I think you were going to jump in and we talked right over.
Yeah. Well, no, I'm enjoying you listening to you both go back and forth. I'm curious what you see that needing to look like on an ideal website. Let's say a company says, okay, we want to build out that content hub. We want to build out that masterclass style setup. What should that look like on a website? In a perfect world, right? What would you do? What would that look like? Is it a custom build? Is it just somewhere that integrates with all of these platforms? What would that be?
Well, what we would say, it all depends, Steve, as all good mm-hmm. marketing answers are. But yes. For the most part, we recommend more of like a content hub approach where we talk about, you know, the knowledge base that exists. We talk about the CEU and if it's available in person and how you can request it, what the learning objectives are, the benefit to your organization. But then we also explain what those on-demand courses are. And we are working with whatever that technology partner can do to make the experience as seamless as possible. So a lot of times it does require a link out to that partner's website instead of being embedded directly into your own. But you don't have to do another login. You have to let them know who you are. But it's as easy as possible to be able to get access to the content that you're looking for at the moment that you're looking for it. Because a lot of CEUs, if you look at that, the time that they're being taken, are also early morning, evenings, or weekends. And people do like to sort of knock it out in one big chunk, you know, if they're trying to get their credits in for their licensure renewal, you know. So you don't want to slow down their ability to access the content, but you do want to make it as easy as possible for you to get to it, for the architect to get to it.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I find too that these content hubs should really be in a section of the website that's dedicated to architects and designers. Because if you kind of try to mix it all in, one, it's much harder for them to find and they're just going to skip out on the website. Yeah. But the way that you speak to an architect is totally different than the way you would speak to an installer or another person. So having that section specifically for them, the CEUs and, you know, all the other information, the BIM objects, right, everything else that they're looking for.
And warranty and install and all the things yes. that they're looking for, because they're really looking for the most documentation of anyone. All right. Well, it seems like a good time to take a quick pause and to ask our viewers or remind our viewers that if you are finding value in this particular episode, that now would be a great time for you to forward it to someone who you think you would like to talk about it. That you're like, ooh, this is great. We were just having this conversation the other week. Or if you are not yet subscribed to The Intersection, hit the subscribe button so that you can be alerted when new episodes drop. So Steve and Danine, let's move on to topic number 3, which is distributor locator. So this is typically something that is on a website already that maybe is just pretty basic functionality. And then it gets real weird when you start to do a website redesign and you want to talk about best in class experiences. And you also are thinking about how you weigh your distribution relationships, because it becomes, all right, who's at the top of the listing? Is everyone listed as equal? From a competitive standpoint, you're thinking about, well, how much do I want my competitors to know my full distribution footprint? I don't want to make it easy for them to get access to this information, but I do need to make it easy for my customers to access this information. So you can find yourself in a conundrum of how you want to treat those relationships in terms of, are you treating everyone as equal, even though their inventory is not all equal? Are you going to make it easier for the installer or the homeowner or the architect to see where it's available in their area, but that makes it easier for your competitors? You know, there's a lot of discussions and logic that end up coming into this discussion. So again, Danine, Steve, what have your experiences been like in terms of distributor, locator, politics, and customer experience?
Throw that all into one big mix.
Yeah. Well, I would say it depends, Megan. It depends. The marketing answer.
It's a good answer. Yeah,
it is.
We could talk about this one for three podcasts.
Yeah, I know. And Danina, I'd love to hear your firsthand experience with this and in conversations that you've had over the length of your experience. But what I'm amazed at, and just as a starting point, is how bad most dealer finders or finding that information is. And I'm talking very large companies down to very small companies. And I think just speaking to the technicality of how they're built, and there's a lot of good companies out there, Snapdragon, companies like that, that offer really, really good tools and integration into your current CMS and things like that. I think at a base level, if you have a dealer finder, it should be really easy to use and it should work. It should not be buggy. We live in a time where you can get that more easily than you have been able. Yeah. So number one, it needs to work, and it needs to work really well. And it shouldn't just be a drop-off point from a marketing standpoint. You should be able to collect a little bit.
Yes. Yeah. No pictures from Google Maps of where the location is, okay?
Yeah, exactly. But I say it because I don't.
But you're right. You're 100% right. Because it really
is. It's rare.
How many times have I done, the research of the digital presence and all that, and been like, oh my God, okay, now how do I get out of this? You can't figure out how to go backwards, or it tries to use your current location and it can't recognize you. There's just a million different ways that it ends up breaking down, but they can be so frustrating to use. So frustrating.
It is a no-brainer, but I called somebody just the other day for a railing product that I'm using in my house, and I called the dealer number that was on the dealer finder, and they were no longer a dealer.
Yeah.
So the dealer page wasn't updated, and these are easy fixes. So if you have one,
did they try and flip you? Did they offer you an alternative?
He did not. I was waiting for it.
No,
he did not.
Bad sales work.
Bad sales work. Yeah. But Danina, I'm curious what you see, and just in terms of more of the political situation, which I think is more of a dilemma for organizations as a starting point.
Well, I can give you a story from my time at T-Mobile, trying to get all the Metro PCS stores on the dealer locator. And so there was over 8,000 national retail locations for Metro PCS. And because we used authorized dealers, the dealers were not allowed to claim a Metro PCS store. They had to use their DBA. And they could say they were an authorized dealer of Metro PCS. And because Metro had no policy whatsoever, and you're talking a company with 8,000 stores, there was every kind of setup possible, right? Every single dealer owned their business page. Metro PCS did not. And most large organizations, they own the dealer pages, the business pages, and the dealers are connected to it. And it's not something that you can just go onto Google and say, Google my business and claim your page. You have to go through the rep, all of this. So we had bad locations. We had non-existent locations. Dresses were wrong. Phone numbers were wrong. Hours. Nothing was consistent. So the first pass was do that. Make everything consistent. It had to be written a certain way, hours, all of that had to be put in there. You had to have at least three images, all of that. And then writing all of the SEO for that. And all of this had to be done before you could even get to a store locator. So because we had so many different locations, we had to work with a Google rep, and we had to go in and claim all of the dealer my businesses locations, and met with a lot of political resistance to a lot of dealers that had built up, really good ratings and stars and things like that. So we had to do a lot of assurance. That alone took us over a year to do. And this was a project that I presented to leadership and led over a couple of years. And when I showed it to them, they didn't even rank from a social, or an SEO perspective. So it was in combination with building out an SEO strategy and building this. But once we had it all completed, then we could build out our dealer locator. And we also built landing pages for each of the dealer. And that's where we put a lot of the data and the copy and the information that they had on their old pages. We could transfer it to their locator page. And we also ranked them. So dealers regularly were ranked based on sales and customer service and a whole bunch of CSAT scores. So it was a place to celebrate them as well. And once we had that completed, our SEO went through the roof for all of our dealers. So we were getting a lot more leads. But the other thing was that the customer service really, the CSAT scores, I should say, really took a jump. And the dealers actually became very happy about it. But to track back politically how this happened, I was in a regional metro office. T-Mobile had bought us. I originally asked to do this for my region. And I was also launching a lot of new regions at the same time. So I presented this to my GM, who was for the East Coast. He saw that and he said, oh, how come we're not doing this? He shared it with our VP of marketing, our equivalent to a CMO. The CMO then was like, shared it with our CEO. The CEO and the CMO came down to Philadelphia. I presented it to them and they went, duh, how come we're not doing this? But it had to go through at least 3 months of layers of getting all of the regional teams on board. There were general managers of some of the regions that were like, no, we can't do this. We have to protect our dealers and those pages. There are others that were, yes, 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 we have to do this. But in the end, I think, you know, the proof was in the pudding. So I would say to any building materials manufacturer, yes, there are good points and there are bad points and there are some competitive issues. But what you will gain by really good dealer locator or store locator, however you want to frame it, is a great lead generation form. Your visibility will increase, your reputation will increase, your leads will increase, and ultimately your revenue. So I would think really serious about it.
Yeah, it's again that intersection where if you've got someone who, you know, who's on your site and is super excited or is looking for you through Google or wherever, that is looking for you proactively and wants to find out where they can buy the product, that if you don't have that right infrastructure in place from a technology perspective to make that findable or easy for the customer to be able to figure out what that location looks like, you again bled the margin right on out of all these great things that you've done to get the customer to that point, right? And there are still a lot of people in our world. I mean, e-commerce is on the rise and is certainly becoming, you know, standard, you know, which is funny to say because, you know, before COVID, e-commerce was not standard in our industry, but now it is standard. But people still want to go to a store location. Even contractors do enjoy, like, the stores where they get to kind of hang out with other contractors at times. They might have certain people whose opinion they really appreciate at a different dealer or location, you know, but the first time they need to get there, they need to know where the heck it is. And so you got to make sure you can tell them where they can buy that product.
Yeah, but it also allows you to track foot traffic. There's so many benefits to this. You know, I shared a story with
targeting the people. I mean, there's all sorts of creepy crawly stuff you can do from a digital perspective. If you can get people into distribution and you can, you know, start tracking them wherever they're going. So,
yeah, I don't want people to feel intimidated by, you know, the story that I just shared with 8,000, because it doesn't matter if you have eight. The story is the same. So. And it doesn't have to be as complex as that. You can implement a really good locator pretty quickly with a lot of the tools that are available.
So in your storytelling, you started to hit on our fourth pillar, which actually is customer service. So customer service can be impacted because things like website improvements, like dealer locators, they're no longer getting calls about, you know, where can I buy your product, because it's clearer on your website, so they're not handling that kind of call volume. Chat functionality, or even just the ability to search and access a website more easily, is certainly more prevalent now. So customer service, a website redesign done well, is going to take a lot of customer service questions off the table, right? But it may result in some new ones, like you're going to get a better educated customer. They might be asking different questions, or you might be asking yourself, so what do I do with my customer service team now? Like, do I need as many people in customer service, or what, you know, how do I handle what this team does? And my personal point of view is, yeah, you still need a customer service team. And a lot of times this is where your customer service team could become more of a prospecting team for you. To your existing customers, and serving up better data and call lists and getting them in a more proactive outbound cadence would be a huge boon for the business to make that team. And it's still in the service of helping the customer. They're just showing up to help in a different way than they had been before. Because typically customer service is a pretty great sales engine for a business, you know, so... But Steve and Denise, what do you see? What's your experience been like with customer service, or, you know, the type of customer, the qualification of the customer that's coming in when you make a website update?
So I've actually talked to a lot of companies about this more recently than in my previous years in experience. And I find that it's oftentimes a goldmine for insight into how to shift product, how to deal specifically with marketing tactics for specific products, and then definitely back to product design and engineering and things like that. But I find a real easy hack that a lot of companies, again, very big companies, very small companies, don't take advantage of is tracking the search feature on their websites. Mm. Because that oftentimes tells you a lot of insight. What are people looking for when they get to the site? They obviously haven't found it, so they're searching for it. And it's more in alignment with customer service or warranty information or things like that, or how to conversations that customer service may have to field. So you can track that in Google Analytics and then get all of those internal searches. And then you'll be able to see what is our FAQ need to look like, and then how do we need to position our customer service or our chat bots accordingly. You mentioned chat bots, and I think that, again, you know, 2 years ago, chatbots look very different. And now with, you know, the connection to LLMs and things like that, you can pull a lot of your product data, product information in a way that is sensitive to pushing away competitors to getting too much insight. There is a way to pull a lot of product insight and data and pass customer service data and create a chatbot that fields a lot of that interactivity that then sales can follow up with, if it's a product information, you know, your current customers and things like that. Again, connecting your sales team and marketing teams with retargeting and things like that based on what they're searching within that chatbot. So I think chatbots today you can get really, really close to the customer in a way that you couldn't, or it was harder or way more expensive to 2 years ago. So I think companies really need to look at how are we utilizing those tools and what tools are available for our specific product, our specific category, and how we do business and how we go to market. And I think that's something that's secondary to the design of the website or the product pages or whatever it may be. And it's actually something that should be more featured on your website, is yes, we have really good customer service. So I think it's a missed opportunity for a lot of companies. It's a secondary conversation that needs to be moved to the forefront. In my opinion,
it's like having a focus group on your website at all times.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, the information that you can glean just about product alone.
Yes. Yeah, I think that customers, so some of the things that get overlooked too, I think, are like in informing a website redesign, are some of the things that you talked about. So like customer satisfaction surveys, the search data that, or, you know, the search behavior that you can extract from GA or maybe some other appliance that you've installed, or just sitting with your customer service team and interviewing them and asking them what kind of questions they're fielding. you're going to get a goldmine of ideas and information about how to better structure your website that's going to make that call volume that's noise and a hassle go down, so that the customer service team is servicing customers with more complex needs or legitimate questions. And I actually find myself, and I guess not that where do I buy your product? That is a legitimate question if you still have that dealer locator we were talking about before. But I even find myself now frustrated if there is not a chatbot for certain types of businesses. So like I was going to a conference and there was some association between if I registered to attend, to be a member of the association, the conference cost one amount. And if I just attended the conference, it cost another amount. And I was going to have to try and call, but there was a chatbot on there. And I was like, oh, this is great. And the chatbot took me through the whole thing very thoroughly about, and it was an AI agent. It said, this is an AI agent, you know, that was able to explain to me the benefits of the membership and what it would look like if I became a member and what it would look like. And it took me like 2 minutes. That would have been a 20-minute phone call. And it was just so much easier to do than to deal with the being on hold or the waiting for a callback or trying to be upsold something else. You know, like it was ideal. So I think consumers are looking for that. You know, our customers are just normal old consumers like everybody else, you know, and, you know, our customers, the building product manufacturer customers are consumers. And the more that they experience these things and have a positive association with them on things like Amazon or Google or other areas where they're used to having this more, you know, robot driven dialogue, they're going to be expecting that on our websites and our building product manufacturer websites experiences as well.
I feel like the hesitation with a lot of companies, especially marketing teams that are building out the website, and the hesitation that they'll hear from C-suite or even from sales is we're losing the human connection, right? If we automate a lot of that activity or you know, the problems and dilemmas that our customers have, we won't glean that information. And I think it's a talking point for a lot of executives within companies that are fighting for that. No, we won't lose that necessarily, or we can have the best of both worlds. A selling point is that if sales handles or fields a lot of those, or it just goes into customer service, you have to make sure that it winds up in a place, a data pool that will be assessed, right? Or reassessed, or it'll feed back into the loop, right? And if sales reps handle a lot of those calls, it most likely will not get into the CRM and certainly will not get back into the feedback loop. And so there's a lot of dilemmas where you're leaving a lot of information on the table by not having it digitized. So you can have the best of both worlds where, you know, even a chatbot or something like that, or customer service form or whatever it may brings you so far. And then you actually do get sent to a rep or somebody or whoever may need to field the conversation. Yeah.
You know, like sometimes there's even you know, different divisions of a business that you know, you might not be sure who the right person for you to talk to is. Like, you know, if you do some initial dialogue with a chatbot, it a lot of chatbots do that deliberately and done well. They can get you to the right person in the right area way faster and, you know, just a much better experience than if you sort of blindly had to explain yourself three times over until you got to the right person.
And the sheer fact is a lot of people want to do their research ahead of time before they talk to a person. That's like they're close to the end step. Mm-hmm. Maybe not the last step, but they don't want to talk to sales.
A lot of Gen Z things.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to leave us here because we're sort of at the end of our topics. I'm going to leave us with a provocation, which is that we are probably in one of the most human to human industries that still exists, right? And we're talking about introducing a little bit of technology and automation to help. And even we're having a little bit of a hard time with it. I mean, we're embracing it, you know, but like this industry is always, I think, always going to be about relationships. And it's always going to be about, you know, there's so much importance on the types of products we install. There's going to have to be a human on the other end of it. But we can, for some of those things that we don't need a human for, we have to be willing to let that go a little bit more, right? You know, and letting go a little bit doesn't mean that we're not a relationship-driven industry or relationship-driven business at the end of the day. It means we can actually develop better relationships, more meaningful relationships, because we're going to be talking about problems and solutions, not where's your store, how can I find the warranty info, right? We're going to be talking about things that are much more important to the people on either end of the phone or, you know, across the table. So guys, I hope this was helpful. This was a non-traditional take on what to expect from a website. Hopefully it doesn't deter anyone who's thinking of endeavoring to do a website redesign project right now, but they are good things for you to be thinking about in advance because they're going to come up along the way, and having a plan for it or being aware of it is going to make it a lot easier to get through all those key decisions that need to be made. So thanks, Steve. Thanks, Denine. And thanks to everyone who tuned in and listened to this edition of The Intersection. Talk to you soon.